nothing is more intimate to us than the food we eat. We have, as a city-dwelling people, agreed to deprive ourselves of the knowledge about our food. This covenant of food ignorance leads us to ask, should we learn the story of our food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 964th edition of the Food Chain Radio program. Or, hey, perhaps you're tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. All you good folks up there in Quebec City. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. And hey, we have engineer Aaron Shore. Aaron, hello.
Good morning.
Aaron, let me ask you a question.
I may have an answer.
Good. Do you want to know what's in the sausage?
I do.
He does. Okay. Also with us today, Anna Ringelman. Anna, the producer from the University of California. Welcome aboard. Anna, do you want to know what's in the sausage?
I don't.
He does. Okay. Also with us, producer Kristen Carlson. Kristen, do you want to know what's in that jug of juice that you have there?
Absolutely. I do know what's in there.
You know what's in there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. So we have a mixed opinion here, folks. When we lived on or close to the land, we knew the stories of our foods. We knew how the foods lived their lives, what they ate, how they spent their days, and how they gave up their lives so that we could eat ourselves. Then we moved into town. Life got different, right? As city-dwelling people, we now live in an average of 1,500 miles away from the foods that we eat. That's a long ways. Given the extent of this difference, distance, we have agreed, in essence, with those who grow, process, package, and ship the foods to remain ignorant as to the stories behind those foods. Instead, we rely on those who sell us the foods to tell us what we should eat and why we should eat that food. There are, of course, significant benefits to be derived from our food ignorance covenant. Chief among them is the fact that we no longer have to spend a lot of time thinking about what's good to eat, and can now direct our time to more fruitful endeavors, like watching television, surfing the internet, texting our friends. However, in depriving ourselves of an intimacy with food, we also deprive ourselves with our most intimate connection with the natural world. This loss of intimacy with the natural world and with life itself leads us to ask, should we repudiate our covenant of food ignorance and learn the stories of our foods? Well, here to help us find an answer, we have Anne Velisis, who is the author of Kitchen Literacy. Anne, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks so much, Michael. It's great to be with you this morning.
Great to have you aboard. Anne, you're an independent scholar and author. Gosh,
yes.
That must mean you're not paid by, like, Monsanto or something, right?
That's right. Especially the first part, I'm not paid. No.
So how is it that you came to write a book called Kitchen Literacy? And there always seems to be a moment of epiphany when you're walking down the road and, you know, somebody drops a safe on your head and you think, oh, there it is.
Yes. I would say it was a moment of epiphany, Michael, exactly. And, you know, I started working on this book probably in the late 1990s, and you guys in California, I was living in the Rocky Mountains at the time. You guys in California are blessed with a great climate, more open thinking, and some wonderful chefs and people who are really into organic farming and gardening and kind of got things going. But for the rest of the country, we were kind of behind you. And so I was just beginning to think about food and the connections between food and how it was produced and sort of the disconnect between what we, the fact that so many people don't even realize how food is produced. And I was walking down the supermarket aisles. I mean, this kind of happened over time, but I just found myself increasingly realizing there are hundreds of products on all the shelves. And, you know, I'd see, you know, like Tony the Tiger and Betty Crocker, these things that were very, you know, products that were familiar, and that I'd seen my whole life in the supermarket. But then I just started to realize that all those products, had real stories, and I knew absolutely None of them. And I was just struck by the utter absurdity of this modern cultural circumstance that we all find ourselves in, or most of the time, you know, when you go to the store, you just don't know what your anything about your food. And I wondered, how did we get into the situation where we know so little about what we eat, what we put into our bodies, and think it's totally normal and ordinary? And so the question that got to me, because I am a writer, but I'm also a historian, and so I tend to think of, the way I tend to frame the question is, how did we get into this situation? What were the steps that led to this? And I was, as I was thinking about, increasingly about problems with food production that I was reading more and more about in the news, you know, pollution, issues.
All the good stuff, right?
All the good stuff that we've all heard, the part that kind of drew me was this question of knowledge, because I just thought, you know, it couldn't have always been like this, that we just didn't know anything about what our foods. And so that's what I put my beat on. I went back through time and I said, I'm going to look at this particular thing, what people knew about their foods and how that changed through time, to see if I can understand that piece, because that's an important piece to understand if we're going to figure out how to do things better, I think.
Well, there's one thing that really captured my attention when I was reading Kitchen Literacy, and I'd like to read it because it was that thing that really fell on, it was a safe that fell on my head when I was reading your book. It goes something like this. The everyday task of feeding families had once depended on the substantial knowledge of homemakers and other household helpers, but more and more, this work depended on what might be called an unspoken covenant of ignorance between shoppers and an increasingly powerful food industry. A covenant of ignorance. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's kind of like a conspiracy. An unspoken, we agreed to become ignorant.
Right. And the way it happened, you know, was, I think, it was incremental. So, and things changed through time. So let's just talk a little bit about the steps, Michael, that led to that, because I think it will help people to understand, better. Initially, as you described in your opening, people knew a lot more about the foods they ate because foods were produced locally, and you and your family had a lot of food production knowledge and skills. You know, you were raising animals, or your neighbors were raising animals.
And not only did you raise the animals, but you killed them and ate them.
Killed them. Yeah, and you used all the parts.
Yes.
So early on, some of the early documents that I used, or, you know, that I used as a historian to figure some of these things out, I went back and I found this great diary of a woman in Maine who was writing about just her day-to-day life, and in there would be details about the foods that she was planting. So when she planted the seeds in her garden, you know, when the eggs hatched for the turkeys, you know, that would be kind of in the spring, and then later in the year, those foods would be showing up as meals that she was making in her diary. And it was so fascinating to me to see the stories interwoven, you know, braided into her everyday life. It's just remarkable because it's so different than most people's experience.
And how in a single sentence she would talk about going out, killing the chicken or killing the turkey, and then eating it and cooking it. In one sentence, it would all be there. She killed it, she cooked it, and she ate it.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, it just, to me, it was almost like evidence of a very different way of thinking about food, just in a sentence like that, you know, than certainly what I had grown up with and what I think most of us experience.
Well, with all due respect, that kind of existence lasted for a long, 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 long time, even up to here after World War II.
Yes,
you speak of the Rocky Mountains. I was raised in Montana, and spent a lot of time on a little farm near Belfry, Montana, and we grew the food we ate. And so you had this tremendous intimacy with the critters, with the plants, with the crops in the field, with everything.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think different people, it happened later in rural areas, so a lot of rural people can understand that, what we're talking about when we talk about having that intimacy. And And early on, Michael, too, I found that as even as people started to move to cities, they still expected to know those things about their foods. And when I was, another kind of source I used in my research was looking at early cookbooks and recipes. And
Hold the cookbooks and recipes and the city, because we have to take a quick break.
Okay.
Okay, folks, today we're exploring our knowledge of food and something that Ann Valaisis in Kitchen Literacy calls our covenant of food ignorance. Did we make an agreement with those who grow and process and package and ship our food to just be ignorant about the foods that they're going to give us? And are we happy with that ignorance? And what happens when we are ignorant? This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, you're talking with Ann Valaisis, the author of Kitchen Literacy, 831-479-1080. Do stay tuned.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
House plants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Well, folks, you know, when we lived out there in the country, we were pretty intimate with the foods we ate. We knew the stories behind those foods. We knew how the plants and animals lived their lives. We knew what they ate because we fed it to them. We knew how they gave up their lives so that we could eat. And so we knew all about our food. Then we moved into town. And we moved into town very rapidly, right? Ann Valaisis, author of Kitchen Literacy. What, it took just like a generation or two and we're all off the land just like that.
Well, they say 1920 is the year that America went from being predominantly rural to being predominantly urban. 1920. Mm-hmm. So it happened in the late 19th century. And, you know, we were talking earlier about we used to know the things that we, about our foods. But then as this transition to the city happened, you know, we had the big problem. How are you going to feed all these people in one place? And so there was kind of a scramble on to figure out how to do that. And initially there were a lot of small food producers, small farms and rings around the city. You know, there was a lot of trying to figure out how to make that happen. And eventually it gave rise to industrialization of the food system and industrialization of meat production, things like cans, packages of food, all that stuff. And one of the things that was really fascinating to me when I did my research is when all those kinds of foods came onto the market initially, there was tremendous skepticism about them. You know, people didn't just kind of say, oh, canned food, how great. Now I don't, you know, I can leave this in my shell, in my cabinet all the time. Or they were really troubled and skeptical about the changes. And
was that because we still had a lot of residual knowledge about food?
Yeah,
when we first moved into town, we still had a lot of, and we still taught each other about food. We still had classes like in home economics and nutrition and things like that.
Well, that actually was part of the transition, I would say, Michael. I would say initially we had the expectations of knowing where our foods came from and how they were made and stuff. But as all these changes started to happen, there were tremendous problems. You know, the food system was haphazardly changing. So there was a lot of food adulteration, you know, people kind of putting unsavory things into our foods. One of my favorite awful examples is, you know, a woman opened a can of chicken and found the whole head of a rooster in there. You know, so, and at the time, those cans, isn't that awful? Can you imagine that happening?
Well, you know, I once worked in a canned peas factory. So I know the story of that kind of thing.
Yeah. And those early cans, they were soldered with lead and zinc, and so sometimes people would get sick from that. The industry didn't know about things like botulism. The technologies were not worked out yet, and so people were getting sick. There were problems. So even women's magazines at the time, you know, nowadays they're filled with ads for all sorts of processed foods. At that time they said, buy foods in as unmanufactured a state as possible. So people were concerned. And they were also concerned about, you know, the new additives and colors. They didn't know, is this something that's
Speaking of colors, that leads me to one of my favorite stories about the transition in our foods, which you portray most eloquently in Kitchen Literacy. And that, of course, is the war between butter and oleo.
Right.
Because I think if there was an example that really defines this transition we made from being country people to city people in our food, it would be the war between butter and oleo. So could you kind of like introduce that to us, please?
Yeah, well, butter was a product a farm product that was made in local areas. It was perishable, you know, it was the kind of product where you wanted to know where it came from, who made it. People understood that butter had a better quality if it came from cows that were eating fresh grass. I mean, the color was different. I mean, there were lots of things about butter that people knew.
Even the color changed in real butter. The color
season,
would change season to season, right?
Yes, it changed season to season. And so people were familiar with that product. That was a high-quality product. But
As long as you were close.
Yes, as long as you were close. But as urbanization happened, it became much harder to actually get that kind of product to market, to supply huge numbers of people. Don't forget, dairies at that time were changing. Cows couldn't necessarily be on grass. They'd bring cows into the city. They were feeding them things like mash from breweries. They were feeding them, more grains like the corn and different things, no longer grass. And also, at that time, the whole meat system had changed so that cattle were being loaded up on trains out in the plains. They were all brought to Chicago where they were mass butchered and cut up, and just the cuts of meat were sent to stores in the East. And what happened is they were using the byproducts of that mass butchering to come up with new things. And so oleo was one of those byproducts.
Byproducts meaning what?
They took the lard and they mixed it with, I think, a little bit of butter, and they put it together, and they were calling it oleo margarine. It was a new product. It was cheaper than butter. It lasted. It didn't go rancid like butter did. And then they started to color it so it looked like butter. And so it got to that heart of the question of, like, here's a product that looks like butter. It's cheaper, but it's not really butter. So what's going on here? Is this authentic? Is this something we can trust? And, of course, there was a lot of variation. If you imagine, it's lard and other stuff, you know, that's in the mix. It was another one of these products that was emerging haphazardly. People, you know, it was a real debate about, wait a second, what's happening to our food? We want butter, and we're getting this other stuff. And yet there were a lot of poor people living in cities who needed some fat, you know, in their diet. And that's kind of what it became, was this, with oleo.
And so there was kind of a war that developed then between people who ran dairies and then people who ran the abattoirs that had these huge factory-like rendering facilities to make oleo.
Right.
And so which one is the best? And if you think about it, I'm sure anybody who thought about it would prefer to eat butter that came from a cow that had been grazing on fresh grass. But not always the case, because if that butter came from a long ways away, not so good, right?
Yes. And one of the chief things in that debate is the dairy farmers tried to prevent them from using dyeing it yellow, because they felt like that was in making their product, making the oleo imitate butter, and that that was an unfair thing. And so you might have heard stories of your grandparents. There was a while in which the oleo was able to be sold with a little capsule of dye that the co-maker could add in at the end. That was the compromise at the time, so that oleo was not colored, but you could color it yourself later. But yeah, very interesting, battle about ideas and quality of food in this process of industrialization. But let me tell you another thing, Michael. The other thing that I found really interesting at this time is this transition period is also the time when advertising kind of came into being. It was in the promotion and marketing of food products was really a way that advertising cut its teeth in our country. And what they basically did is at this time, the stories of how food were made, the kind of traditional things people expected to know, where, how, that kind of stuff, all of a sudden became unappetizing, right? You don't really want to know how your oleo margarine is made.
You don't want to know what's in the sausage, right?
Right. And so they kind of started basically attaching new kinds of stories to food, right? And so at this point, you get, at the very beginning, you'll see there's advertising that talks about where food came from and how it's made, but very soon thereafter, they start attaching different sorts of ideas to food. Some of them initially are things like pleasing associations with nature. One of my favorite is the product shredded wheat, which is still around today. It was made in a massive factory at the brink of Niagara Falls, believe it or not. It was actually, the factory was powered with the force of Niagara Falls. It was a hydropower factory. And so they made a big deal about their factory using the potency of the falls and somehow making that factory-made product something, you know, that was this wonderful thing that you could get in if you ate it.
So we're going to take a quick break, Anne, but when we come back, we're going to pick up advertising and how advertising supported our covenant of food ignorance. Do stay tuned. Yeah. Right back. Well, consider for a moment butter and oleo. Now, if you think about butter, you can see a pleasant pasture of green grass and a contented cow out there chewing her cud, and then there's the butter, right? Right from the udder. Oh my goodness, how wholesome and how great. And then you turn to the oleo made from the fats rendered from a factory farm with thousands of dead animal carcasses, and you think, oh my goodness, how could anybody go for oleo when there would be butter? And yet that did happen. It was a transition that we made. And who convinced us to make the change? Anne Velisis, author of Kitchen Literacy, has an idea.
Yeah, so we were talking about the role of advertising in all this, Michael, and pretty much advertising set new criteria for what was important to know about our food. So, you know, before it was where food came from and how it was made. Around the turn of the century, there were new ideas. You had mentioned earlier nutrition and I don't know if you mentioned germs, but another thing that came up is we became aware that germs could be a problem, that foods could be a vector for disease. And that's, of course, because it was made in these haphazard ways in all these new factories. At the time, a lot of what we call factory production was actually people in lines doing the work.
And not washing their hands.
So nowadays we see something on an ad that, or, you know, on a food label that would say homemade or handmade. But at that time, some of the words and advertising and on packages were not made by hand. You know, that was sort of one of the criteria. And increasingly, the other idea that became important were more things that were just like, I would say intangible things like prestige, the idea that a food might, using a modern food, made you somehow seem like a smarter, more up-to-date, modern person.
Something like white bread?
Something like white bread, yes. In some of the interesting ads about that, about white bread, for example, they would actually try to make a homemaker feel like she was inferior if she served homemade bread, and that maybe her husband would be unhappy start, you know, either talking to his neighbors and complaining, or perhaps even have a fling on the side because she wasn't serving the squishy modern white bread, you know. So the ads would start to play on people's anxieties, and, you know, they just started to do all these different things and really changed our thinking about what was important with food. And so, you know, that was happening. And then also at the same time, we started to have supermarkets came into being. So, you know, before there were markets that had maybe a small number of products, these kinds of new products, or farmers markets. The big markets in cities were kind of more akin to what we call farmers markets today.
Mm-hmm. And then along came Piggly Wiggly.
Piggly Wiggly was the supermarket chain in the South. Such a funny name. And it's still there in the South in many places. You know, and the idea there, some of the ideas actually underlying all of this is the idea of specialization, which was part of industrialization, you know, that we break down the steps and we figure out how to be ultra efficient, you know, efficiency, specialization. The supermarket was designed to lower prices and, you know, the idea was lower prices sell huge volumes of food. And this, of course, also depends on cars. You can drive out and into a place that's a really big market that has a lot of food in it, so people could come high volume, low prices. That was kind of the economic model. But when you get into that circumstance, you get into this weird deal where there's hundreds of products on the shelves. And quite honestly, it becomes, how are you going to know about those foods anymore? You know, I mean, that traditional of expectation of knowing about foods literally becomes kind of impossible or mind-boggling. It's a problem. And so that's where getting back to this idea of the covenant of ignorance. At this time of transition, I was reading around and trying to understand, well, what was going on at this moment? And I found the writings of a woman economist, Christine Frederick, and she wrote, at the time she said, you know, it's getting to the point where women just don't want to be bothered with the burden of knowing all there is to know about their foods anymore.
Have you seen the YouTube piece on Portlandia when the couple go into an organic restaurant and they sit there and they start asking the waitress about the chickens?
Yes.
Do you know where the chickens live? Do you know what their names are? On and on and on and on. It goes on and it's just...
Exactly.
And so we don't want that, did we?
It gets to that point, you know, like where's the line? How much do you know? How much can you know? And so it's a real problem. And her solution at that time was the idea that of specialization. Well, why don't we as consumers, because of course that time it was women who were doing the shopping and the cooking and really making the decisions about what to eat. We will just get to know food by brand names, and we will let the manufacturers worry about everything else, where the food comes from, if there's enough vitamins in it, if there's, you know, that it's clean. And she just really proposed this division of labor. And I just found it to be so fascinating that at that transition point that somebody conceived of that it's a problem to know your food, that it's hard in this context. So, of course, at that moment when this transition happens is precisely the moment when food, the industrialization of the food system really picks up. We've also got, that's when synthetic nitrogen comes in and, you know, that fuels animal agriculture and just a lot more changes between the wars in terms of food industrialization. Herbicides, pesticides, I mean, all those things come in, and I think people are, you know, just right, are in the mode of just thinking like, well, I don't know, and it's okay for me to not know, because this is sort of the new modern way that we know that we live.
And so we made this covenant with those who grow and process and package and ship our food that it's all too much for us to know. We're too far away from it to know it. We're 1,500 miles away from where the food grows. There's no way we can know anything anymore. So we agree to be ignorant about it and to trust you.
Yeah, and so we bought into this system. And, you know, I mean, and I think oftentimes as a historian, you see when you go back and look at the past, we try to solve different problems. You know, we tack one way. We think, okay, this is, we're solving a problem of kind of cleaning up food in our cities and supplying people, getting more food out. In some way, I mean, some people have called it democratization because more food becomes available to more people. It's cheaper, all that stuff. But then, of course, through time, you know, within the development of industrial agriculture, you know, by the time the 60s come along, then we're starting to read about, you know, DDT showing up in the mother's milk of people that are living far from farms. And so it's coming through the food chain, pesticides, additives. You know, by 1970, it's 5 pounds per person per year. All these kinds of
things. Wait a minute. What was 5 pounds per person per year?
Additives, you know, that in
five,
the diet.
We were eating 5 pounds of additives per person per year?
Yeah. So like those minute amounts of what was being put into boxes and cans and whatever, preservatives, colors, added up to that at that point.
And wow. So we're going to take a quick break. Ann Velisis, author of Kitchen Literacy. But when we come back, I'm going to ask about, you know, what price we pay for this covenant of ignorance. And, well, what the heck? Should we just stay ignorant? And what is the cost there? This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Ann Velisis. Kitchen literacy, the subject. Should we know about what goes on with our food? Should we know the stories? Should we want to know? Or should we remain blissfully ignorant and trust those who sell us the food? Do stay tuned. Right back. Well, way back there in 1879, a Virginia congressman named Richard Lee Beale said, and I quote from Kitchen Literacy by Ann Velisis, the rapid advance of chemical science has opened a wide doorway for compounding mixtures so nearly resembling nature's products that our senses are impotent to detect the difference. Wow. And it really was that way. You know, Ann, we were talking about how advertising talked us into eating so many things that we probably would not have eaten otherwise. And that was the way it was way up until, what, Rachel Carson wrote The Silent Spring?
That started to open the door to people, I think, beginning to think differently, or at least some people starting to think differently. I call it in my book Kitchen Counter Trends because, you know, that was the era of questioning authority, and people, I think, started to realize, what the heck is going on here?
Why was there no journalism before that? There was. I mean, there were some incredible accounts of, you know, what went on in the stockyards and what like and whatnot. But
yes, and honestly, if you go back and you look very carefully, there were movements of interest in the 1930s. I mean, there were movements all along of people trying to raise questions about foods and different ways. You know, early people writing about organic agriculture, early people writing about this issue of additives.
Yeah.
There were always trends, but I think the 1960s. Really was the first big push towards saying, you know, starting to ask questions of the industrial food system. And, you know, like so many things that great generation asked and raised questions about, they made some progress in raising awareness, but, you know, and we had the beginnings of an alternative food system begin to arrive. That's when organic agriculture really got going. We had started to get food co-ops and things like that. But I think it wasn't really until more recently, like the 1990s, and I actually credit, I think in part it had to do with finally getting a broader acceptance of organic food label, that it started to go out farther, and more people had the option for the first time of having different kinds of foods. And almost, you know, it's like, it's one thing to, if you're criticizing the whole thing and saying, oh, this food is bad, it's awful, but there's nothing else to do, you know, what do you do as a consumer? You kind of say, oh, I'm just not going to think about that, because what am I going to do?
There's no alternative.
Gave a new option. And other things that changed, you know, in 1985, I think there were just like something like under 20 farmers markets in the United States. And since then, you know, with interest in organic agriculture and, of course, local agriculture, that number is now over 12,000. And so we had this incredible uprising of interest. I think genetically modified foods also. I mean, in the 1990s, all of a sudden we went from, to having, you know, like over 90% of the products in our shelves having GMOs in them because so much processed foods have soybeans and corn in it. You know, so all of a sudden there was a new upwelling of questioning and wondering what are we into? Is there any other way? And so, of course, people really did start to ask that question and answer it. I do want to know the stories of my foods. And that's kind of what I came to, you know, as I was doing my research. You know, everybody wants to tell you what to eat. You know, should you be a vegetarian? Should you only eat local? Should you only eat organic? Everybody wants kind of a prescription to be the what they're supposed to eat. And it just came to me that what we need to do, I think, is learn the stories of our foods. And then, you know, each of us is going to make our own decisions based on what works mm-hmm. well. But knowing the stories of our foods, you know, enables us to make good decisions. And it also, it really, I think, in my own experience and that of many, I think it enriches our experience of life, of cooking and eating. And
it brings us back to nature, too, because food is the connection that we have with nature. You know, what you're talking about reminds me of a year or so ago, I did a presentation to the International Biotech Convention in Chicago. The audience was an audience of genetic engineers from Monsanto, DuPont, and whatnot. And on the panel with me were some farmers from the corn people, the soy people, the hog people, and so on. And in conclusion, I said, my conclusion was that you folks, speaking to the genetic engineers, have done a wonderful job with this marvelous new technology because you've made it possible for these farmers that I'm sitting on this panel with to grow crops in ways that they've never been able to do before. One farmer can grow 1,000 acres of soybeans with no weeds or bugs, and that's a miracle. And you've made them very happy, and you've made yourself very rich. But sooner or later, the consumers of your product are only going to know the story of the foods they're eating. And the story of this food is that it's drenched in herbicides and infused in pesticides. And what story are you going to tell them to convince them that what they're eating is worth eating when they ask what's for dinner? And notably, my conclusion was edited out of the final piece for some reason. But though you can shut me up, there's so many other people who are asking, you know, what's the story? And so in the few minutes left, I guess I'd like to talk with you, Anne Velisis, the author of Kitchen Literacy, where this is all going to take us. Do we really want to know what's in their food? How much do we want to know? Because, as you said, there is a limit to how much we can know before we absolutely go bonkers trying to know it all. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with Anne Velisis, the author of Kitchen Literacy, an Oregon girl sitting up there on the coast of Oregon contemplating the food we eat. I bet you do once in a while as well, don't you? Do stay tuned. We will be right back, and we will have a conclusion as to what we should know and should not know about the food we eat. Welcome back. How much do you want to know about what's in your food? You know, it seems to me like there is a war going on between what we should know and what they don't want us to know. A good example of that war, of course, is the effort by so many people to label foods that contain genetically modified organisms. And the efforts by those who manufacture those foods to prevent us from knowing. You know, hundreds of millions of dollars are being spent to convince us that we should not want to know about the GMOs in our food. So, but that's just one, you know, front in this war. That's one battle. And there are many others as well. So how much can we know before those who don't want us to know are going to stop us? Anne Velisis, what do you think?
You know, I think your point about the food labeling thing is, you know, that's a strategic big question because that affects so many of the foods that we eat. And of course, I mean, that's kind of when I come down to how am I going to do this in my life? I need to have a food system that gives me that information easily. And so labeling foods in that way would be so helpful. That's what many consumers want to know. And of course, right now, the organic label does give us that so far. The other ways that we know foods, I mean, I think we just have to figure out ways to build our own food systems in communities. I live in a small town, I'm sure Santa Cruz is like this, where people are basically creating alternative food systems that give them that assurance right now. Mm-hmm. And
I call it food with its farmer's face on it.
Food with a farmer's face on it or a fisherman's face on it up where I live.
There you go, good enough. Town. Yeah, amen to that.
We've got a lot of that going here in many places all around the country. And so I think there are different fronts that we need to, that people who are interested in these topics need to work on. The kind of stuff we're just talking about, and also that political front of making sure that we can have food labeling. I mean, it's just a crazy thing that they're spending so much to try to
And it's, you know, labeling not just of GMOs or not GMOs, but it's mandatory country of origin labeling. You know, that's a law that we should be able to know which country our food comes from, and yet that law has not been implemented yet. So it goes on and on and on. The more we want to know, the less they want us to know. So this is wonderful conflict there. Can we win?
I think we can win. I mean, people are so passionate about this now, and I think the more we are aware of how, for example, in the past, powerful advertising and the industry has been in shaping our sense of what's important, it can help to make us realize what's at stake now and how if we don't win, it's going to be hard. But I don't doubt that some other methods, other modes will kind of come up if we don't win the food labeling battles right now. Something else will emerge because it's too important. People really care about it.
So even if they win this, they haven't yet won the war because we will come back.
Yes, I think so. You know, as you said at that conference, people want to know the stories of their foods. And so it's something that many of us, at least, are pretty invested in figuring out.
Well, Ann Velizis, want to thank you for joining us on The Food Chain. Kitchen Literacy is the book. Lots of fun stories in the book about just about everything. And if you want to learn, as so many people do want to learn these days, this is a great place to start. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. What do you think?
I'll ask the gals here now. Do you want to know what's in the sausage, Anna? What do you think, Anna? Do you want to know?
Well, as a vegetarian, I don't eat sausage, so that's not as personal to me. But I think that people who eat it should want to know.
All right, we're out of here. Thank you, folks.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.